Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay.
lessons for future presenters. Well, really, it's lovely to be here with this crowd. I mean, especially in honor of Z's memory, and to be on a program with all of you is a little bit flattering for myself, and I'm sure other people in the room too. This is a relatively new paper. I think Pierre is the first person to read a draft outside of the authors. And you might look at this and say, oh my goodness, another World War II paper. If you know my work, I've written a couple already. And frankly, I thought I was done with this body of work and a little bit reluctant to write a paper on science itself. And yet the more I read about the context and the history here, the more I started to think there's actually something here that at least I want to learn more about. And we'll see what we can get from this paper as we're making progress. So why don't we begin as follows. So, what I think tees this up pretty well is, if we kind of look back in history, the 1950s and 1960s was a pretty extraordinary time in life sciences. Breakthroughs in a number of different areas, the emergence of antibiotics, the antibiotic revolution in the 1950s, the development of a whole raft of new vaccines for a range of infectious diseases. You're looking right here at the childhood vaccine schedule we have today. Advances in protein science, ultimately molecular biology with DNA, and the emergence of the modern American pharmaceutical industry, including firms that actually weren't in the industry before World War II, but entered the industry through World War II work. And so what these different developments have in common is they all have lineage that traces back to work that was being done during the war to support the Allied war effort. And that's what this project is generally going to be about, military medical research in World War II and its impacts. And this might at first seem kind of arcane, because you think of war and you don't think of drugs and medicine as a first order thing to prioritize. You think of bombs and artillery and aircraft and radar and remote detection and things like this. And yet the thing is, medicine is actually foundational to the conduct of war. Prior to World War II, and every war prior to World War II, as many or more soldiers had died of infectious disease than of any kind of battlefield injury. And military strategists knew this. General Douglas MacArthur explaining early on in the war, being quoted, "This will be a long war for every division I have in battle. I have to count on a second one that's in the hospital with malaria and a third one convalescing from this disease." This is just, of course, one of many examples. And so kind of the theme of what's taking place here is kind of captured by this quote from someone who was involved in some of the work I'll be telling you about. War augments some medical problems that are already prevalent in civilian life, but also introduces new ones. And stepping in to attack these problems was the Office of Scientific Research and Development. It was a new agency created in World War II to fund and coordinate research on war problems. Its Committee on Medical Research, which did so for medical, military medical issues. And this was, for its time, kind of an unprecedented policy experiment. There had never been any significant U.S. investment in medical research. The NIH existed at the time, but it was small. It was mostly intramural. And so this comprised a pretty substantial shock to the biomedical innovation system as it existed at the time. And to give you a sense of what's on what's in the problem set, so to speak, right? Everything from treatments for infectious diseases like antibiotics and antimalarials, methods of controlling the spread of those diseases, including the populations they spread through, but also vaccines. But then it gets into things you might not expect, like the separation of blood parts, extracting plasma from blood so you can actually dry freeze it, its own innovation problem, and take it to the front. Or blood substitutes, steroids, understanding the effects of sleep and oxygen deprivation on the human body, on human performance, and so on. We can go down the list. And so what we want to understand in this paper is really two things. First, what were the effects of the CMR, wartime research investment, on post-war science technology? But then from there, we want to try to take a step back and see, ask ourselves, in what ways does CMR actually fit the way we think about innovation and the structures we understand it through, or in what ways might it actually challenge some of our current thinking on innovation and innovation policy? So there's a lot to build up to as we get through this, so let me go ahead and start moving a little bit quickly. To give you a little bit more flavor of some of what was taking place during the war, two of the major research efforts were around penicillin and malaria. Penicillin being a pretty remarkable new antibiotic discovered in 1928 by Alexander Fleming, but really there was no method for producing it at scale for even enough quantity for human testing at the dawn of the war. And so this is one of the problems that CMR took on. You know, cultivating natural penicillin, growing it from mold, was mostly a production problem, but also developing a synthetic penicillin is a chemical problem, both of which were targets of CMR work. The malaria program ultimately produced the synthesis and screening of over 14,000 compounds over the course of the war, really the first large-scale drug screening that we've seen. And so the heart of this project is going to be new data we've collected from the records of this agency. We have records on all of its contracts. This is just a snapshot of one part of one of those contracts that was let to Edwin Cohn, a physical chemist at Harvard Medical School, for blood studies. And this contract actually was the center of CMR's blood program, which involved over a dozen universities and firms and hospitals. A very distinctive way of doing research. The Cohn Lab at Harvard wasn't just doing bench science the way you might think would be the case in a physical chemistry lab. They were doing that and many other things up to running an actual pilot production plant for separating blood at scale and then transitioning the output of that work to industrial firms. And so post-war views of this particular program, for example, described it having provided a framework for post-war research on blood, blood-related diseases, blood-derived therapies. And so we kind of want to examine this in a more systematic way across the universe of what CMR was engaged in to give you a sense of more of these contract titles and, again, kind of like the breadth of stuff that was important in the war and that it was directing resources to. You can just take a quick scan of this slide right here. I literally just made this yesterday, picking some quasi-random examples. So in order to study this in a more systematic way, we have to find some way to convert the contracts to a common space. And that space is gonna be medical subject space. So the National Library of Medicine has produced a hierarchical subject taxonomy. The MeSH tree here, medical subject headings is the acronym, as well as provided a tool to map input text to the tree. And so we use that tool to take all these contracts and convert them into these subjects that CMR touched. And you can, just to give you a quick look at how this works and what we get from it, looking across CMR's six divisions, medicine, surgery, aviation, medicine, and so on, you know, take a look at the top list and see what are the subjects with the most associated contracts? Syphilis in medicine, burns in surgery, oxygen, altitude, hypoxia, aviation medicine, DDT in chemistry for insect control, and so on. And so, I mean, not only does it give you a preview into what was taking place, but also actually some prima facie evidence that it seems like the classification tool delivers something informative. And so what we're going to do with this then is take it to the publication record as we examine how subjects that were shocked by the war evolved afterwards. And so we're taking about 5 million publications from Microsoft Academic Graph in the years around the war, indexing it to medical subject space the same way we did with our contracts, and then effectively estimating this two-way fixed effects specification with time-varying effects. But the data here are existing at the subject-by-year level, and we want to understand how these fields evolved after the war. And the very first thing that I'll start you off with is evidence that of both continuity and change. I mean, some subjects, as we noted before, that were presented by the war existed before, were subjects of research before the war. Here I'm cutting the data on subjects that were above versus below the median number of pre-war publications. And so you can see that that adage of war presents old problems and also new ones seems to be present here. And in particular, the new topics that were a target of CMR work appear to have taken off during and after during the war and had some sustained growth afterwards. I'm going to skip this for time and keep pushing. And one of the really, I think, striking things about this too for us is that this was an explicitly applied endeavor. I mean, there were problems that needed to be solved urgently. A lot of the work was directed towards synthesizing and testing drugs. And yet the effects seem to have filtered back upstream into basic research, a theme I'm going to come back to later. And that's not the end of the story, because a shock like this, which was pretty systemic, I mean, it touched so many subjects, so many areas of medicine and medical research, that we can also think about what were its effects on technology and ultimately medical practice itself. And so to do this, we need some new resources, because at the time, for example, the FDA Orange Book wasn't yet being published. There is, however, a more historical resource that lists drugs that were FDA approved year by year. We have about 1,000 such drugs. We'll harness this. We also harness medical textbooks. So major medical textbook series that were published both before and after the war. We can index those as well and see what subjects do they contain. Are they educating students on? Are they available to practicing physicians on? And we can effectively, in connecting these to subject space, run similar regressions. And what we find, in essence, is concordant effects that we kind of showed before with science, only this time it's downstream, where there's a surge in drugs, in therapeutic uses and mechanisms of action that CMR was active in, and a long-run, essentially the addition of CMR-funded subjects into medical textbooks, too. And so all that's, to us, super interesting, and even then, we're still left with questions like, okay, but why were these impacts so long-lived? CMR, after all, was decommissioned at the end of the war. It was technically a temporary undertaking. One part of the story can actually be the rise of the NIH, and I'll probably have to pass over the meat of this for time, but frankly, the NIH, as we know it today, was effectively born off the back of CMR. It didn't have a large extramural funding program until CMR was decommissioned, and it absorbed its remnants, the contracts that remained, and used that as the nucleus to grow its extramural funding programs. And even then, so we've collected data on all NIH grants and fellowships, data that I think Pierre has used or accessed before too, and might say something about or might not. But when we include this and we can control for it in our regressions too, or split the samples on subjects that were versus weren't NIH funded, our results now are still there. It's not a story of NIH picking up where CMR left off. Instead, and this is where kind of the empirical record seems to reach its limits of what we can do, at least what we've figured out how to do. But when you dive into the history, it's really fascinating. You can only start to understand what was taking place in these fields as they emerged from the war. And what it looks like is taking place is they're coming out of the war with a bunch of new research assets, new tools and new inputs, new therapies and candidates, new technology platforms for developing antibiotics and vaccines, for example, new capabilities among researchers and universities and firms. And really, most of all, new fundamental knowledge, which surprised us. But this is the one that comes up over and over across these histories, is that new understanding was developed in the course of pursuing wartime problems that then became a foundation for post-war work. And so let me bring it back around to what I think we're learning from this. How am I doing on time, by the way?
Mm-hmm. You're doing pretty well.
Oh, am I?
More than 5 minutes.
Okay, well, that's good. I want to be able to linger on
this.
Don't
slow down, right? Keep it up.
Maybe I can work out a slow drawl instead. I know. I won't torture you, don't worry. So things that we think we're learning from this, and again, this is work in progress. We're still thinking about how it is we're going to tie up the paper in the end. It's developing, but The first is an understanding of what CMR-like approaches to research policy might do. And this is important. I mean, there's growing interest in these kinds of approaches to supporting science and technology, top-down, integrated, actively managed, we kind of think is bundled up as mission-oriented policy, but there's not a lot of good empirical evidence on its effects. Heidi, Nick, and John point this out in their JP on the Innovation Policy Toolkit, and we think that this is an opportunity to add a little bit to, not necessarily fully resolve that question, but add a little bit to it. It's relevant to current developments, including ARPA-H as well. And so we have some evidence of spillovers that this kind of investment can have on science, technology, and practice, which then leads to my first hat tip to Zvi in our, we'll be good, the search for elusive R&D spillovers, which I'm sure many folks are going to reference that paper over the course of the next 4 days. This seems to be one example where we see those present. But beyond some program evaluation, I think there's actually more to this story and more to this paper. And the first of those deeper things is going to be that I think this paper really challenges the conception of the linear model itself. CMR doesn't really fit neatly into applied and basic research buckets. First, there's use-oriented basic research that does take place in the course of these contracts. The Donald Stokes view, the Pasteur's quadrant, so to speak. But really, even that's not enough, because a lot of what was taking place under this effort, it just bundled it all together. I mean, the blood lab at Harvard Medical School had researchers running a plant at the same time as they were doing bench science to try to understand what's the content of blood fractions and what can they be used to treat, or what are they, how does the composition change when you change production methods and things like this. And even then, even if you take the basic and applied dichotomy seriously, the linear model is premised on innovation flowing from basic research to technology development to production to diffusion. But here we have application leading the science. So it turns a little bit of the logic around. And that's not necessarily a new idea. And others have pointed that out too in other contexts. But here I think it just becomes very crystal clear. And it's consistent with this view. This is a quote that I've kept in my pocket for many years from a former DARPA director, that in science, often when you're working on applied problems, you find your way to fundamental ones, which is when we read the history of and also look at the evidence here, what we think we see taking place. But the last thing I want to tie us off with is that I think this episode provides a little bit more perspective on productivity and the burden of knowledge. And of course, I'll be fascinated to know what Ben has to say about this too, either in Q&A or at the break, and so we'll save that for a second from now. But this post-World War II in science and innovation just, to me, comes a little bit at odds with mechanistic predictions of declining productivity in science. Because at least for a time, it just looks like new science became possible. And in some of these new subfields or like branches that emerged out of the war, enabled by things like antibiotics, new model proteins, I haven't even told you that story, it's a great story, or blood separation techniques, there was opportunity. There was research opportunity. And maybe there are ways we can try to formalize that more. But what that leads me to be thinking about really is how one of the most important, in my view, now coming out of this paper, it seems, but under-incentivized categories of work, is innovation that reduces to the invention of new methods of inventing. Another Gerlich's reference here, one of the ones that comes from my favorite paper, the hybrid corn paper, the OG of diffusion studies, even before Rogers. And that is innovation that enables new subjects to emerge and grow. With that, I think, in order to be respectful of our time, I'll go ahead and tie it off. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So thank you for inviting me to discuss this really wonderful paper that I had a great... So I'm very honored to be the first one to read it outside of the authors. Dan did a wonderful job describing the results. I'm not going to rehash them, and I want to kind of put put most of my effort on this kind of like meta level of what it can teach us, right? And so double clicking on this topic of mission oriented research, right? It can mean a lot of things, but at its core, it means that there's some amount of top down priority setting. And it's kind of an alternative to what is the dominant mechanism of science funding, at least in the US, but you could say also increasingly in Europe as well, with the, and of course the name escapes me, Reinil, the name of this new grant, of the ERC grants, right? Thank you, right. I'm gonna blame jet lag for this. Which is bottom up and investigator initiated. So I'm gonna refer to that as, you know, MOR and IIR in the presentation, right? And it's an active policy debate, right? Is MOR better than IIR? Which sounds like a bit of a silly question. I think it's probably more productive to think about when and under what conditions MOR might be a better way of making progress. But then, of course, as well, if actually one is going to invest in mission-oriented research, like how would you organize it? And I think that Danielle and Bhavan are taking kind of a meaningful first stab at this agenda by really putting under microscope the US World War II effort with the CMR, right? So here's what's interesting. This was such a ridiculously low investment. I mean, it's $450 million, $2024, right? Spent between 41 and 45. But it's actually quite big relative to the scale of kind of publicly funded, or maybe just like any, you know, just biomedical research in the US at the time, which really had been the province mostly of foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation. And it was retargeted at not so much, I wouldn't say a broad range, like a medium range of domains that were thought to be useful in wartime, and Daniel described this really well, right? And what's interesting is that much of this research actually did not bear fruit early enough to actually affect World War II outcomes, right? So we didn't get synthetic antibiotics, for example, in time, and even like the key, you know, antibiotic that made a lot of difference is not penicillin, it's more streptomycin that arrived kind of in 47, 48. But did it shape biomedical research over the long term? And I think based on the evidence that Danielle and Bhavan presented, the answer is kind of a resounding yes. Right, so what they're doing is to map those 500 plus contracts onto intellectual space, right? As kind of reduced, as projected onto mesh terms to shed light on which area of the scientific landscape were activated by the war effort. And then they examine differential growth patterns of various outcomes for activated versus non-activated areas between 1930 and 1970, right? And one thing, I'm always reminded of this quip from Tim that if you're going to be, he told me this about one of my papers, that if you're going to be thin on X, you better be broad on Y. And this is exactly what this paper is, that there is just a broad tapestry of outcomes here, publications, publication types, drugs, NIH grants, mentions in two leading medical textbooks, right? And I think what gives confidence in the results overall is that the results are pretty consistent across outcomes with some nuances, but which means that basically the activated terms and areas expand during the 1950s and 60s, particularly if they had not attracted a ton of interest before the war, right? And then progressively they tend to revert to the mean in the 60s and, you know, by the early 70s, certainly, okay? All right, so that's what the paper does. And then the question is, and it does it really, really well, in my view. And the question is, what can we conclude from that? So first, I'm gonna have a set of questions / quibbles. So, you know, once again, correlated technological or scientific opportunities rear their head. Can you really say for sure when many topics had very, very little activity before the war? And to me, the thing that puts me at rest is, in fact, we see the effect petering out by the mid to late 60s, okay? I think if it had gone on forever, in some sense, that would have been more worrisome, right? The thing that I wonder a little bit, and I think you know, like putting the reader's mind at ease on this would be useful, is can you really map pre-World War II titles and abstracts onto terms that came into being only post-World War II, right? Because like the language that the scientists at the time might have used may not have been, you know, they may have used very different language to describe kind of research in the same area. And so that seems inherently hard to do, but it's actually kind of important for the research design. And then finally, you know, they project everything onto mesh terms, but those mesh terms you might think of are not kind of completely independent. So there's kind of a spatial autocorrelation in intellectual space that they haven't really modeled yet. And I think that's going to be something that they probably need to do. But I want to kind of mention a number of different things they could do. And I think I said those are lowish hanging fruits. In truth, I think some are really low hanging fruits. Others might be pursed a little bit higher. So first, you know, thinking about the role of NIH in kind of sustaining this effort, like what the NIH needed to do is to kind of partition the intellectual space to allow scientists to review each other's work in those committees called study sections. And, you know, the history of creation of those study sections is known. It would be kind of interesting to know which ones were kind of congruent with CMR topics and which one were not. Second, you know, we know the PIs of this, we know the CMR PIs, but we also know NIH-funded PIs in the 50s and 60s. So who did the follow-on work? It seems to me, you know, knowable, and it'd be interesting to know if it's the same PIs, if it is the trainees of CMR PIs, if it's other PIs, if there's like non-US PIs involved, that would be interesting. Okay, and then two things that I think are not low-hanging fruit, but to me sound really interesting. The first thing is, I'm all for the study of spillovers, but CMR was meant to help, you know, to really help the U.S. fought a war, right? But as it turns out, the U.S. fought two other wars in the 50s and 60s, one in the tropics. And so I think it would be really interesting to see the extent to which those CMR investments and then the trajectories that they engendered actually paid off within the context of military medicine. And you know, I don't know this would require kind of access to recourse to health records from, say, the Vietnam War, but I think that would be really interesting. Second, thinking about kind of about the efficiency of this enterprise, like mental health, and you know, was just like not a topic of concern at all. And so there's a sense in which I think mental health and neuroscience were areas that were treated in reverse by CMR.
Concussions and PTSD, but yes, broadly.
So I think, you know, and this came up, I think, during the Vietnam War, that became much more of a concern, like including, you know, reflected in popular culture. So like when thinking about kind of the welfare effect of an initiative like this, it's kind of interesting to think about. Okay, what does this tell us about the burden of knowledge, right? So what Bhavan and Daniel tell us is that maybe what's happening is that new fields are always being born, and so it's always springtime somewhere in intellectual space. And I'm not so sure. I feel like really with Kuhnian-style paradigm shifts is the only time where you may actually reset the clock of the burden of knowledge. And everything else is like a little bit of sand in the gears, but to kind of to delay kind of inexorable, you know, exhaustion of scientific opportunities. Now, I'd like to think that studying sand in the gear is actually a very legitimate topic of social science research in this area. So I think it's great, but this is not the only type of sand in the gear that exists. And then what does mission-oriented, you know, when does mission-oriented research work well? I think, you know, we had N equal one, that was DARPA, and we have N equal two, that's CMR. I just want to note that seems to me there's something about the theme of emergency that comes up, but also the theme of if you're going to do MOR, it better be extramural. Like all the examples of mission-oriented intramural examples that we have are kind of a little bit of a disaster. Now, it's still just N equal two, but, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. So I'm stopping.
Awesome. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.